The second case for oral argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Marcus J. Soon. Mr. Soon is the appellant. He's represented by Mr. Robert Feit, an attorney from Brookings, and the State of South Dakota is represented by Ms. Ann Meyer, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Once again, the court would like to welcome students from Esteline High School and Villa Dual High School and South Dakota State University. Mr. Feit, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson, Justices of the Supreme Court Counsel. I appreciate being given the opportunity this morning to present oral argument on behalf of my client, Marcus Soon, in a case which involves a fundamental and cherished constitutional right which all citizens of our country enjoy. That is being the right to freely express our opinions and ideas. The First and 14th Amendments to our United States Constitution guarantees all citizens of this state that right. That right also includes the right to criticize our government, our government's agencies, without fear of or threat of criminal prosecution. To quote from the words written by Chief Justice Gilbertson in this court's decision in South Dakota versus Martin, as freedom of expression facilitates the free-flowing exchange of ideas and debate, which occupy the very heart of our democracy, any government regulation on the content of speech is subjected to the strictest of judicial review. It is our contention that the trial court's construction and application of subsection 2 of South Dakota's disorderly conduct statute gave it an unconstitutionally broad reach which deprived Marcus Soon of his First Amendment rights. The facts of this case are straightforward and not disputed, having been presented entirely through the direct examination of Brookings Patrol Officer David Gibson. At 2:02 a.m. on September 2, 2007, which would have been an early Sunday morning, Officer Gibson was riding as a passenger in a patrol car which was traveling down Main Street of Brookings. As the bars had just closed, the sidewalks had filled with bar patrons, and Officer Gibson testified that a crowd of 100 people were standing out on the sidewalk. He further testified that his passenger side window was down and that he heard someone yell profanities and that he identified Soon as that person. Officer Gibson testified that he heard Soon say 16 words, which for purposes of today's argument, unless the court feels otherwise, I'll summarize as a critical profanity-laced commentary towards cops.
Do you concede that your client was aiming the comments at the officer?
No. I think Mr. Soon made a general commentary towards law enforcement. At that particular time, there had been no contact between the law enforcement officer, any particular law enforcement officer. I think the intended target was law enforcement in general.
Right. But was it at the patrol vehicle? I understood the comment to be directed at the officers in the vehicle as they were driving by.
There was no testimony to that fact. The only testimony was that I think the traveling of the patrol car down Main Street precipitated the contact by Mr. Soon.
Well, there was eye contact where Mr. Soon was looking directly at this officer when he was making these comments.
The officer testified that he made eye contact with Mr. Soon after the words were said. That is correct.
How can you take that position that they weren't directly at the officer when the second sentence that he spewed out was, "You blanking cops suck"?
Well,
I mean, clearly that wasn't a commentary on the general status of police enforcement throughout the world or anything.
Well, I don't believe it was a personal attack against this particular officer himself. I think it was an attack against...
Sounds pretty personal to me.
I think it was an attack against the profession itself.
Doesn't make a difference, the fact that the commentary was about policemen, as opposed to if one of us judges were driving through and they would have made the same comment and substitute judge instead.
Well, I think if the target of the critical comment was directed towards a police officer, then there's even a narrower exception to the fighting words rule than would apply to an ordinary citizen. I think what the U.S. Supreme Court decisions have told us in Lewis versus City of New Orleans, we've got Texas versus Hill, all of those cases have indicated that there is a higher standard or a narrower standard to be applied towards police officers.
Do you think that's fair, that we should comment on that, that a police officer needs to have a thicker skin than maybe some people from another profession?
Well, as Justice Powell said in his concurring opinion in the Lewis decision, police officers are trained for this type of thing. They should have a thicker skin because they deal in this every day. And arguably there should be a higher standard that does apply to them.
You know, this wasn't Sunday morning with people leaving a church service. This was Saturday night or early Sunday morning with the bars emptying out. Does the context in which the comments were made, where you've got 100 people standing on the side of the sidewalk, obviously many who have probably been drinking, does that create an additional risk or danger that ordinarily you wouldn't see in everyday life that turns these comments into fighting words?
No. I think, to the contrary, it's probably just the opposite. The court's reasoning was that if any one person in that crowd would have found Soon's words offensive, then that alone is enough to convict Soon under the disorderly conduct statute. That clearly is not the constitutional standard that the courts have set out.
How about those words that incited the crowd against the officer?
Well, Texas versus Johnson involved a flag burning case in 1987 where the argument of the state of Texas was similar to what the trial court found in this case. In that case, Johnson had burned an American flag. Texas argued that he was liable, he was guilty under a statute which made it a crime to desecrate the flag. Desecration was defined as doing something that one or more people would find so offensive that they would violently react to. In that case, the court, Justice Brennan speaking for the majority, said that the average person would not violently react to that, even if they feel strongly about it. The court in Cohen versus California, where the defendant in that case wore a jacket with the F word, F the draft, into the municipal courthouse during business hours, the court also said in that case that even though people would find it offensive and distasteful, would not agree with it, that nonetheless the First and 14th Amendments don't allow us to prohibit that kind of language or conduct. The trial court's objection to the language used in this case was the profanity, and that's the only thing that's involved in this case is Soon's speech. This is not a case of mixed conduct and speech. This is a case that only involves speech, and that is the words that were used by Soon. This court said in SJNK that mere profanity can never be the basis for a conviction under our disorderly conduct statute. And, that's the precedent that was established in Cohen versus California.
But if he were trying to incite a riot, the court recognizes an exception for that. If you're using profanity and other epithets to incite a riot or to incite people to violence, the law clearly prohibits that. But as I understand it, in this case, there was no evidence that the crowd was incited by this, your client. In fact, the crowd, as I understand it, was disenchanted with your client, surprised at what he was doing. Is that the facts?
Well, the testimony of Officer Gibson at most was that people in the crowd took note of Soon's statement.
They said that they looked at him like, what are you doing?
Now that
the test is the test, whether or not they did, he did incite them to riot or whether or not it was likely to.
Well, the trial court, there were no findings by the trial. There was, first of all, there was no testimony by the state that anybody was inconvenienced, annoyed, or alarmed by Soon's statement. There was no testimony from the police officer to that effect. There was no testimony that anybody in the crowd was inconvenienced, annoyed,
or alarmed. What is the test, in your view?
That, as Houston versus Hill stated, that the words spoken have to be shown likely to produce a clear and present danger of a substantive evil that rises far above public inconvenience, annoyance, or unrest.
So you don't need an actual riot, it just needs to be likely to cause one.
Well, clear and present danger that rises far above public inconvenience, annoyance, or unrest, yeah. Now, but the trial courts...
Which is an objective standard for a court to make, not an officer standing on the sidewalk seeing whether a riot plays out or not before he decides to make an arrest.
Well, yeah, the trial court never found Soon guilty for any reaction that was actually carried out by either the officer or the crowd. What the trial court said was that Soon's statements created a risk of someone being offended to those comments. And the trial court found that the utterances created a risk of inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm to any other person in the crowd, and that risk was based upon any one person's sensitivity to the utterance made by Soon. But the court went on further and said that because of the size of the crowd, the fact that there were 100 people out there, that a real risk existed that at least one person would have been offended by that comment. And that, given the size of the crowd, a real risk existed that at least one person could have been offended by Soon's lack of tact or the disrespect that he showed to law enforcement or this officer in general. And certainly the constitutional bar that the trial court set out in construing the statute fell far below the precedents that have been firmly established in the area of First Amendment rights. The court has over and over again, in Gooding versus Wilson, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a Georgia statute which made it a crime to use language which was likely to cause a disturbance of the peace.
You cite those cases, and most of those cases have actually challenged the constitutionality of the statute. That's not the case here, is it?
No, we've not made a facial challenge to the constitutionality of the statute.
Is that a different test then? Can we use that same test that the courts have used in determining whether the words fall within the constitutional protections? When the statute itself isn't being challenged, but whether or not it falls within disorderly conduct definition, is there a difference, or do we need to look at that differently?
I don't believe so, Justice Meyer Henry. As you know from the opinion in South Dakota versus Osmussen, where the court discussed at length the First Amendment overbreath doctrine. We're not making a facial challenge to the statute itself. We're making a challenge to the constitutionality of the trial court's construction as applied to Soon. And under that overbreath doctrine, it's our position that this court has to make a decision whether the trial court construed that statute in accordance with the Constitution. And that's irrespective of whether or not the court would determine whether or not Soon's words would even constitute fighting words. I think the first thing you do is you have to reach that issue of whether or not this was a constitutional construction of the statute. These exceptional rules, as set out by the court, apply because of the chilling effect that an overbroad construction of this statute would have on people that are not before the court. And certainly the trial court's construction of the statute, where if one person out of 100 were annoyed by a comment made, would have a chilling effect. That's not the legal standard.
Right, well, the standard's fighting words, not whether you're annoyed. I mean, people are annoyed all the time by what people say.
Well, Unfortunately, though, the trial court in this instance did not apply the fighting words standard to the construction of the statute. The trial court found that Soon's words were fighting words, but the test that the court applied, if you look, when you read the decision and the memorandum opinion of the trial court and look at the findings, is all about whether one person out of 100 would have been annoyed at either the choice of the words used or the disrespect or lack of tact. So that certainly doesn't meet the constitutional standard.
So the appropriate standard would have been to try to determine whether the comments were likely to incite a riot, not whether they were going to annoy people who were on the sidewalk, correct?
Well, it certainly would have had to been construed in accordance with the fighting word standard. And you know, the U.S. Supreme Court decisions, in their review of speech-only statutes where the state is attempting to make it a crime to say something without respect to conduct, have looked with disfavor on all of those statutes. If you know, the Houston versus Hill court firmly said that these statutes are unconstitutional if you just simply say that it amounts to a breach of peace or likely to incite a riot. There has to be a much higher standard than that. I believe in order to construe the subsection 2 of the disorderly conduct statute, you're looking at subsection 1, where you're talking about the engaging in violent, threatening behavior. If you apply the Szaplinski fighting words exception to subsection 2, you end up with subsection 1. And this court, in the SJNK case, went through in some detail and discussed that. But in this particular case, there was no face-to-face confrontation between Soon and the officer. In fact, as the officer testified, Soon ignored him. He after saying these words, when the officer confronted Soon, Soon had his back to him, and because of the fact that Soon was ignoring him, he grabbed him and handcuffed him and arrested him. There was no other conduct other than the words spoken by Soon. So unlike the situation in SJNK, this did not involve a case of mixed conduct and facts. It only involved a case of speech.
He was arrested not because he made loud noises, it's because of the noises, the words that were in those noises. Is that what you're saying? The court didn't say it was an unreasonably high noise or a loud noise. It was the words that were in the noise that he was convicted of. Is that right?
That's correct.
So if he had been shouting, "Praise the Lord," or "We love police officers," at the same tone of voice, not likely he would have been arrested, not likely he would have been convicted?
Well, the court never made any finding on unreasonable noise, and it was never, you know, it's apparent from the findings of the trial court and the conclusions that the trial court based everything on the content of the speech. This was not a content-neutral application of the disorderly conduct statute.
He was only charged, though. I mean, the charge against him was making unreasonable noise. Is that right, or is
that is correct.
Okay.
And that was an apparent realization by the state that this case only involved speech by Soon. It did not involve any of the elements set out in subsection 1 of the disorderly conduct, which make reference to the fighting or violent or threatening behavior.
But you're not challenging the conviction on that ground. You're not challenging it on any ground other than the words. I mean, you're not saying it doesn't fit the statute.
Well, we are challenging that, Justice Center. Our challenge is twofold. We're challenging the fact that there was a constitutionally overbroad construction of the statute, and secondly, that the words that used by Soon did not constitute fighting words and did constitute protected speech. The sufficiency of the evidence, if you look at the trial court's test, certainly there's possibility somebody would have been offended by those words, but the sufficiency of the evidence, if you apply a proper constitutional standard, certainly would fall far short of being what was required.
So if I understand what you're saying is that there is no circumstances where if you just utter those 16 words with no physical follow-through that they could ever violate this statute.
I cannot,
they are protected no matter where and when you say them.
Well, I think the only way that you could ever violate that statute, if you put in a constitutional interpretation and construction on it, would be to have conduct that approaches what's in subsection 1. And that would certainly require, under the Shaplinsky rule, that you have some sort of threatening or fighting words. So you're really moving up to subsection 1. I don't think you can, by the time you construe subsection 2, you really have subsection 1.
Maybe I wasn't clear in my question. Is what you're saying is no matter where the circumstances, these 16 words are uttered, if there is no other physical follow-through, these could never be fighting words?
That is correct.
Okay. And your time has expired.
Thank you,
Mr. Veit. Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
Yeah, please, the court. A lot of the state's argument has been covered, but the point that Justice Gilbertson made about this being the whole context and the whole circumstances is what Judge Foley was looking at. If you look at his conclusions of law, and I'm talking about conclusion of law 9, the court says that what is important is the effect on the public, including the police officer. Our statute is talking about annoyance and alarm and creating that risk and inconvenience. The crowd is the key factor here. We have 100 people coming out of the bars in Brookings who presumably have been drinking. The risk is there of trouble. Because the officer intervenes, we don't automatically jump to subsection 1 of our disorderly conduct statute. If that were the case, the defense could have objected on the sufficiency of the complaint before trial, and that would be the issue, whether we charged this defendant out on the correct subsection of the statute. That's long waived, and that shouldn't be the argument here today. And again, what's important is that Sun made a disruptive noise. These people who heard this noise were not blank slates. They looked at him like, what are you doing? Nobody wants to hear somebody disturbing their peace with profanity at 2 in the morning. That is prohibited as an unreasonable noise under our disorderly conduct statute. And the trial court, that's what the trial court was looking at. He also made a specific reference to SJNK. He said the words that the defendant uttered are strikingly similar to what you see in those cases. There are still cases cited in that opinion that said you don't need violence, like Shuler v. State. To be fair, some of the more recent cases do look at conduct and the words said. But our statute says creates the risk. And that's what this officer was looking at, and that's why he cited, or arrested, or found probable cause for the violation of our disorderly conduct statute. Jumping to the first subpart of that statute, the time's passed for that. Justice Meyer Henry is also right. There is not a constitutional challenge to the statute per se. There was no notice to the Attorney General's office in this case. So we're looking at the words of the statutes and the statute and the element of the crimes, and our position is that we've met that.
So, as my understanding then, what the challenge is that the words are protected constitutionally. Therefore, if they're protected, there can't be evidence then to support disturbing noise or the unreasonable noise portion of it. So that then there's insufficient evidence if you can't use those words against him. Is that kind of the theory?
Well, we made an argument in the alternative in our brief, and if you just look at the elements of the statute, whether the trial court looked at content under a right for the wrong reason analysis or just the elements of the statute, when you're looking at unreasonable noise, that we can get there as far as a crime, even without the content of the words that he said.
So just the fact that he, I didn't realize that that's what you were arguing.
In that last paragraph.
That wasn't argued to the trial court, was it?
No, we're using a right for the wrong reason analysis because by the time I get the case and do the research, that, you know, I've noticed that in Indiana and Oregon. So, you know,
is there any evidence, though, in the record about the decibel level of this noise or anything else that would normally, when you think about unreasonable noise, you're thinking of a loud music or whatever coming out of something or a machine next door that's too loud and you can't sleep. But what, there was no evidence of that, though, in this case, was there?
About we don't have a decibel reader. That's correct. And that's a good observation. But it's, you know, for this, again, the context and the circumstances. At 2 in the morning, he's just letting fly with, you know, his profanity towards police officers and the public, and everybody's caught up in that. And that is an unreasonable noise, as our statutes are drafted by our legislature at this point in time.
Would you concede, then, if he had seen Officer Gibson on the sidewalk and walked up and there was just the two of them, looked him in the eye and said these 16 words, that they are probably protected? If no
different word? Situation. Different situation. Eye-to-eye, face-to-face conduct in an interview room, something like that. Yes. Officers, however, as the defense noted, and the court talked about this, the argument Justice Powell made was that the officer is trained to not, you know, start to be belligerent back. So that is a narrower situation. And we don't have that one-on-one here.
And it isn't like they haven't heard this word before.
No, I think that some of the cases are really interesting because they say standards of decorum have changed. They change generation to generation. They change more quickly than that. When I'm reading the cases, it seems to me that it's changed just since the 90s. And we're in this flux of our language is not highfalutin, if you want to look at it that way.
Those particular words in my era would have gotten your mouth washed out with soap. Now you hear them on television.
Yes, or music. Rap music, anything like that. And that would have been my generation, too. But you know, it's just how society has evolved. And the reason for that is that the commentators say that, or in the cases say, that we're a strong enough society to absorb that kind of profanity or that kind of off-color remark in the interest of protecting our freedom and ability to speak our minds. This is America. We get to speak our minds. Things like that. So, are there any further questions?
Yeah, I have one. I've been to athletic events, and they start these chants back and forth. They're heckling, and sometimes they get about down as base as this is. Are we going to start, if we uphold this, are we going to start hauling people out of the stands at football games and arresting them for chants that border on this as constituting fighting words?
Depending on the context and the circumstances and how disruptive it might be, as a general chant or a cheer, that probably sounds absurd for a police officer to do that. If somebody's really, really obnoxious and everyone is offended, annoyed, there's a tremendous outburst of certainly people who are reacting, saying you better shut up or I'm going to take you out, that kind of thing, yeah, that could cause a problem.
But truly, the test is not whether people are annoyed, is it? I mean, doesn't it have to be an objective as opposed to a subjective test?
It is an objective test, but to be fair, there are more recent cases that do say that you need some kind of conduct with the profanity or the invective that you're using. Our statute, however, says that you're creating a risk of public annoyance, alarm, or inconvenience. So, to a certain degree, you know, we're bound by what our law says. And we have to look at those elements and apply the facts to that.
Unless it's unconstitutional.
Unless it's unconstitutional, which I might add is waived in this case. So, does anyone else have any further questions? Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. The explanation to the audience, the attorney is not required to use the full 20 minutes. When they complete their argument, they're entitled to sit down.
We don't hold that against them.
No. Mr. Feit, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson. Just to address the time, place, and manner argument that was raised by the state, or that Judge Foley was right for the wrong reasons. That's an apparent concession to our argument that Soon's words did not constitute fighting words. But that was never argued before the trial court, was never raised by the state. And this is similar to the argument made by the state in the recent decision of State versus Morris, where it was held that this court will not consider an additional theory of guilt for the first time on appeal. And that's essentially what the state is arguing. But irrespective of that, there were no findings, absolutely none, by the trial court that this was a case that involved unreasonable noise. Nothing to indicate that anybody was even disturbed by the words used by Soon.
You know, Do you think the state of the law now is that if it's just the content of the words as opposed to adding on additional conduct, that it doesn't meet the constitutional test? That words alone can't? Do you think that the law has moved to that point?
That's absolutely what I believe. I believe speech alone, without getting to the conduct that would rise to the level of fighting words, violence, or threatening behavior, can never be constitutionally criminalized. You know, the test for a content-based application versus a content-neutral application is you need to look at the content of the speech in order to determine whether or not the speaker violated the statute. And if you have to look at the content, then the statute's content-based. In this particular case, it was, without question, the content of Soon's words that got the attention of the officer and got the attention of the trial court in its findings. I hypothesized in my brief what the reaction of the officer would have been if, under the exact same circumstances, he had shouted, "Brookings police are the best, keep up the good work, thank you for all your service." Or, for that matter, instead of referring to cops, if he had referred to attorneys. The point is, the reaction would have been completely different. And clearly the conviction rests upon a content-based application of the statute. This court, I think, made a good analysis of the Shaplinsky fighting words in its SJNK case. The trial court relied heavily on that for its position that Mr. Soon was guilty under the statute, and I think that reliance was misplaced. This court was clear in its SJNK case that you need more than just mere speech. You need a case of mixed conduct and speech.
So what was the distinction, then, you think, between that case and this one?
The fact that this is a speech-only case, Justice.
But what did the juvenile do in the SJN case?
Well, I appreciate your concurring opinion in that, where you made the distinction between a content or between a mixed case of conduct and versus a sole case of speech. But in that case, the juvenile had pursued the intended target. They'd pursued him in a vehicle. There was a continuing course of conduct that had gone on for some time. You have the obscene gesture that was made. But that involved a face-to-face confrontation, basically, between the juvenile and the intended target of that conduct. In this case, we have none of that. There is no face-to-face confrontation. There was no continuing course of conduct by Mr. Soon. In fact, as I indicated before, Soon didn't confront the officer. The officer confronted him, and the officer said that Soon ignored him. So there was absolutely no conduct beyond Soon's words in this particular case. And that absolutely distinguishes it from the SJN case. It absolutely distinguishes it from all of the cases cited by the state where, for the proposition that a profanity directed towards a police officer can support a conviction for disorderly conduct. In my reply brief, I analyzed at length the factual situation in those cases. Every one of those cases involved some sort of face-to-face confrontation, and it involved some sort of continuing course of conduct and or some sort of context that put it in a threatening manner. And all of those distinctions that were present in those cases are not present in this case. Therefore, I don't believe there is, getting back to your question, Justice Meyer Henry, I don't believe there's any way that Soon can be convicted for speech only. But our challenge is twofold. We're saying that the court unconstitutionally applied the statute, and we're saying also that Soon's words were protected speech. And I think they deserve separate consideration. I don't think we've waived anything as far as challenging the construction of the statute. I think this court has to look at the trial court's construction of it, and if the statute was unconstitutionally construed, then it is unenforceable against Soon. We don't have to challenge the statute in order to preserve that under the First Amendment overbreath argument. The cases that we're relying on were all precipitated by a period of unrest in the 70s brought on by racial tension, an unpopular war. But those are the legal principles that were established that make our democracy what it is today. Soon's words weren't nice. They probably upset the officer. That's why he was arrested. But nonetheless, he had that right to say those critical statements. As Justice Brennan noted in Texas versus Hill, our right to criticize the police is what separates a democracy from a police state. Also, many of us were taught by our mothers growing up the saying that sticks and stones may break our bones, but words will never hurt us. So, too, in this case, I urge you to reverse the conviction of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Feith.